Hello, I'm Dr. Monica Peek, and I'd like to welcome you to The Weight of Inequity, addressing the social and structural barriers in bariatric surgery. This case-based CME activity is supported by an educational grant provided by Johnson & Johnson. During our discussions today, we'll disclose if any therapies or procedures mentioned are off-label or investigational. So again, my name is Dr. Monica Peek. I'm the Ellen H. Block Professor of Health Justice, and I'm also the Vice Chair for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in the Department of Medicine at the University of Chicago. I've been a primary care physician for more than 20 years, and so I treat patients with a range of chronic diseases, including obesity. And so I'm thrilled today to be talking about management strategies for obesity. And I'm pleased to be joined by two of my very distinguished colleagues, whom I'm going to ask to introduce themselves. And I'll start with Dr. Hussein.
Hi everyone, I'm Farah Hussein. I'm a professor in the Division of Foregut and Metabolic Surgery and the Vice Chair of Education at Oregon Health and Science University, where I also serve as the Program Director for our General Surgery Residency. I have practiced metabolic and bariatric surgery now for 19 years, and I'm very excited about being a part of this discussion today.
Great, and Dr. Salas.
I'm Argavon Salas. I am trained as a bariatric surgeon and also do work in social science. And so I've done a lot of work on implicit bias in different, realms, including obesity. And so I'm really delighted to join this conversation. As far as where I sit, I currently am a clinical associate professor of medicine at Stanford University.
Great. Stanford's one of my alma maters. I always love that place. All right, I am thrilled to have you both with me today to be talking about this issue. This is a disease that affects so many Americans, and your expertise is really going to be wonderful. So I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. We have several learning objectives, and so after participating in this activity, our audience should be better able to do several things. First, assess the impact of implicit bias and structural inequities on the referral patterns, access to bariatric surgery, and post-operative outcomes across diverse patient populations. And then second, to implement evidence-based approaches to reduce disparities in bariatric surgery. And so by way of introduction, we can see that 40% of adults in the United States are living with the disease of obesity. And so that is almost half of us. 10% of Americans have class three, or what we call severe obesity. And so associated comorbidities are things that I treat every day as a primary care physician. So hypertension, type 2 diabetes, high cholesterol, heart failure, osteoarthritis, cardiovascular disease, not to mention, gallstones and a range of other things. And so, and cancers. I didn't really realize how many different cancers were associated with obesity. And so it is this a chronic disease that really is driving a lot of our other chronic diseases that are causing a lot of morbidity and mortality for our patients and escalating healthcare costs as well. So, Dr. Hussein, can you provide a little bit of a background for us about how bariatric surgery can address some of the problems?
Yes, of course. Bariatric surgery now is often referred to as metabolic and bariatric surgery. And so you may see that term being used quite a bit as we've come to understand more about obesity being a chronic disease and a disorder of how our metabolism may work. The most important thing that many patients will ask first is it safe treatment? And we do stress that it is a very safe treatment. It's very effective and has durable results. There are a lot of newer procedures in addition to very old procedures being done now, and all of them have shown quite safe efficacy across the board. With these procedures, you do expect them to have improvement in both health outcomes and quality of life to be effective surgeries. Bariatric endoscopy is a newer field. It's where we use a special scope to adjust things within the stomach. And that can include placing intragastric balloons or doing something called an endoscopic gastroplasty, where we actually sew the stomach from inside of it. Bariatric surgery, again, also known as metabolic surgery, includes things like your sleeve gastrectomy, Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, and biliopancreatic diversion with duodenal switch. If we go to the next image, you'll see pictures of these representative surgeries. Now, these surgeries are complicated on the inside, but done with small laparoscopic or robotic incisions. So on the outside, a lot of times they'll look similar to gallbladder surgery or appendix surgery. But on the inside, I'll start with the sleeve gastrectomy because that's the most commonly done procedure across the world. We remove about two-thirds of the stomach in the sleeve gastrectomy and make your stomach more the shape of a tube, or it's a sleeve shape is why it's called that. The Roux-en-Y gastric bypass has been done since the 1960s, and in this procedure, we create a small stomach pouch that's about the size of the palm of your hand, or 4 ounces. And we connect that pouch to your intestine, bypassing a section of your intestine that is heavy in absorbing fats and sugars. The adjustable gastric band is still listed on this because it is done in other parts of the world, but it's not really done in the United States anymore. So we consider it more historic. However, there are patients that may have it placed in Meditourism type cases where they're going to Mexico or et cetera, or there may be patients that have the band now and want to have information about this as well. So we like people to know that that's a plastic or silastic instrument that was placed around the stomach with the idea of creating kind of an hourglass squeeze on the stomach to let it slowly empty. And then finally, the biliopancreatic diversion with duodenal switch, or what I like to call the DS or SADY, is an old and now new procedure. It was done originally in the 70s. It had some outcomes that weren't great back then, and that was when we really didn't work with patients as much, quite honestly, and give up enough education and information about the procedure. And now we've modified it into what we consider a much safer version of the DS, and has a very powerful hormone response that's really strong for patients with diabetes and at higher weights to really optimize weight loss across the board. In this case, we do a gastric sleeve as the first stage, and then we bypass the last part of the intestine, again, causing some fat and sugars to not absorb as well. The key to all of these surgeries, though, is that they are all metabolic surgeries with the exception of the band. And what that means is they all cause a hormone response that feeds back to our brain. And that's really what causes the results here. It's not how big you're making my stomach or how small, but it's really how strong of a response in these hormones do we have that help us feel fullness and change the way we digest and absorb some of our nutrients.
Great. And that's excellent information to know. We know so much more about the hormonal status and the connections between our brain and the signaling than we knew when I went to medical school. And which I always tell my kids was in 1932. And so I like the idea of calling it a metabolic surgery because it helps just patients and society really understand that this is a metabolic disease, not just one of willpower. So Dr. Salas, can you tell us about some of the guidelines about when primary care physicians should think about referring patients for bariatric surgery? Because I know the guidelines have changed over time, and what the guidelines tell us.
Yeah, absolutely. As you're alluding to, for a long time, we were going off of a NIH consensus statement from the early 1990s. And so folks who work in this field, bariatric and metabolic surgeons, were for a long time saying, this is wild. Like, we really need to update. Our society has changed so much, and the rates of obesity have changed so much, and our understanding of how to treat obesity has changed so much. Why are we still using guidelines from 30 years ago? And so a couple of years ago, these new guidelines came out from ASMBS, which is the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery, and IFSO, which is the International Federation for the Surgery of Obesity, to really modernize the indications for metabolic and bariatric surgery. So for adults, the indications are now for a patient who has a BMI of 30 or greater with other medical problems such as diabetes or high blood pressure, or other things that may be related to metabolic issues. And then for patients who have a BMI greater than 35, who don't need to have any other medical problems, just that level of obesity itself will be qualifying for bariatric surgery. Well, I should just say, there's also a growing interest in and need for adolescent bariatric surgery. And so for adolescents, the guidelines are for patients who have a BMI that is either greater than 35 or greater than 120% of the 95th percentile for their age, who also have associated medical problems, or a BMI greater than 40, or a BMI with that is greater than 140% of the 95th percentile for their age. Also, there, you know, when I was practicing clinically, there would often be patients who are in relatively good health, aside from obesity and maybe a couple other medical problems, who are older. And the question would always come, is there a benefit for those patients? And I think there's a growing recognition that there really can be. It's very, it's customized to the patient and looking at their individual risks and benefits. But there is not a specific cutoff beyond which we don't offer bariatric surgery to patients at this point. In addition, there are some other special situations in which bariatric surgery may be considered for patients, in particular patients who are need some other special surgeries but don't qualify for them just yet because of their obesity. And so those are patients, for example, who may need a joint replacement, an abdominal hernia repair, or organ transplantation. And so bariatric surgery can help patients lose weight and become healthier in the interim so that they can qualify for these other procedures that they need to have. In general, as Dr. Hussein said, the key procedures that are most commonly offered in the United States at this point are the gastric bypass and the sleeve gastrectomy.
And so one of the things I just want to just add is that for me as a primary care physician, I remember years ago, very few of my patients would be eligible with insurance coverage for this procedure. And now almost all of my patients, or many of my patients, have a BMI that's greater than 30. 30 is the lowest point for the consideration of obesity. And so many of my patients have diabetes, hypertension, some comorbidity. And so that means that many of your patients are going to qualify or meet the guidelines. And so it is not the same sort of high step for thinking about who might be a candidate. And so as we're now in a phase where almost everyone is trying to be on a GLP receptor agonist and thinking about the long-term expensive medications, the overall cost of having a surgery may be in the short term or in the long term more cost effective.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And certainly we're seeing different trade-offs now than, say, even 5, 10 years ago, in terms of weight loss and treatment of obesity. And these are, again, going to be kind of individualized decisions in terms of what the patient's goals are, both personally and for their health. And also going through surgery, obviously, is not a minor ordeal for folks. It's a big deal, especially these surgeries. Even though, as Dr. Hussein was saying, that for the surgeon, they're technically not too onerous. We can do these within some of them as short as a half hour, some of them a couple of hours. But they're relatively straightforward for us on the technical side, and patients are only in the hospital briefly. So, in that sense, it might seem like it's not as big a deal as, like a Whipple, a pancreatic cancer surgery, but it's still a really big deal for a patient and they're in their lives and having to take time off work and having someone help them and support them, because these changes, although they're made through these little tiny holes, they're pretty major on the inside. And so patients do need a fair amount of support afterwards. So these are, important conversations for patients to have, both with their primary care providers, and then also if they do get a referral for surgery, to talk with their surgical team about whether it really is the right thing for them. I do want to highlight something that Dr. Peak brought up, which is that more patients certainly are eligible for bariatric surgery now, but even before these expanded guidelines, a very small proportion of patients who are eligible for bariatric surgery were getting referred for surgery. And there's lots of reasons, I'm sure, for that, including the things we were just talking about, that surgery is not a minor thing. And so people may be hesitant to recommend that for their patients. At the same time, we do have and continue to have a growing obesity epidemic. And so it's helpful, I think, to start thinking perhaps a little bit earlier on in a patient's journey about whether surgery might be what's going to most help them. And I think to this point of, who's eligible and who's getting referred, we do see disparities in that, which I'm going to talk about in just a minute. But I want to also address the disparities in outcomes for patients that we've seen, with certain minoritized groups seeming to have, on multiple different data sets, worse outcomes after bariatric surgery. And this is consistent with really any other medical condition that we look at, where patients from different backgrounds don't always have the same outcomes. In particular, for example, you might think about maternal mortality, and we know that Black pregnant people are 2 to 3 times more likely to die related to pregnancy, or due to pregnancy-related causes, than are white pregnant patients. So it's the same type of issues that we see throughout our healthcare system, which are obviously multifactorial and complex. We know that there's some what we call social determinants of health, but also I would add bias on parts of various members of the healthcare teams, and also outright discrimination. As much as we'd like to think that doesn't happen, we know from data that it does. It is a part of the human experience, unfortunately. And there are roadblocks for some patients to access bariatric surgery, whether it's due to insurance and just access to healthcare overall, or whether we as physicians or other healthcare workers think of bariatric surgery as a referral for all patients equally or equitably. And even when patients do have access to bariatric surgery or metabolic surgery, different populations, as I was saying, may have worse postoperative outcomes and persistent disparities, such as even in our society, structural racism, environmental racism, food deserts that don't affect all our patient populations in the same ways. Those can also contribute to differential outcomes. And for us as bariatric surgeons, I think we really want to think about how do we make bariatric care more equitable? How do we improve access to bariatric surgery? And how do we optimize outcomes for patients coming from all different backgrounds? And so, to go on to talk a little bit more about access to bariatric surgery, there are multiple studies that have looked at both who gets referred and then also the outcomes of patients. And the key points are, as I was mentioning earlier, that we see the same types of patterns as we see for other health problems. So, some specific data we can discuss here are, for example, a study that looked at referrals out of it was a single center study looking at who among their patients who met criteria for bariatric surgery were getting referred. In that study, they found Hispanic patients in particular, this was a study in Virginia, were less likely to get referred for bariatric surgery. And you see the rates here, about 2% of Hispanic patients were referred versus 5%-ish for Black and white patients. And in that particular study, when they tried to understand why that might be the case, in again their single center experience, those patients who self-identified as Hispanic in their data set were more likely to be self-pay, meaning not have health insurance. And that could be a part of why they were not being referred, because of course surgery is relatively expensive. It's hard to know to what extent that particular finding may generalize, but other data suggests that there are other barriers as well, like this other study that was done looking at the referrals to cardiology. What they found was that patients of different races and ethnicities were relatively equally likely to be referred for evaluation by a cardiologist, but Black and Hispanic patients were less likely to undergo testing, in particular via stress tests. And it's hard to know exactly, what is driving that difference, but we see again in almost any arena that we look at, that Black and Hispanic patients and other minoritized patients are not necessarily getting the same access to healthcare, either providers or testing or procedures. And then the last thing I want to say here is that when we look at outcomes, as I've kind of alluded to, we do see differences in outcomes for the among those who do go on to have bariatric surgery. And this study that looked at data from what's called the MBS AQIP, which is basically monitoring outcomes for all patients who have bariatric and metabolic surgery at qualified centers, that they looked at those data from 2015 to 2021 and compared about 220,000 patients, Black and white patients, and looked at their outcomes, and they matched them. So they did a case control kind of comparison. And what they found was that across mortality, readmissions, and certain complications, including thromboembolism, that Black patients had higher rates of those negative outcomes than did white patients. And I think the reason we talk about all these data is we need to be thinking about what contributes to these disparities, and what can we as individual healthcare workers, as individual physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, whatever our role is, how can we incorporate best practices into what we do to do whatever we can in our part to improve these outcomes? And not to say that that's the key lever necessarily, because I think, again, we do have some systemic and structural issues that we need to be thinking about, that our health systems, for example, need to be thinking about, and certainly that our society needs to do a better job of addressing.
Thank you. That is always sobering data to look at, but it's always good to have that a reflection of what is happening and to understand that it's a reflection not just of individual behaviors, but also systemic issues that all come together to make it challenging for our patients. And so, Dr. Hussein, maybe you can introduce a patient case. So we've had a lot of data. Let's translate that into a real scenario. And so this case I know was informed by an actual patient, patient experience as we were sort of developing this activity. So I'll hand it over to you.
Absolutely. So the patient we're going to discuss in the next few moments is going to be Angela. Angela R is a 47-year-old Latina veteran. She has a body mass index of 44 kilograms per meter squared. Her medical comorbidities include type 2 diabetes, hypertension, sleep apnea, and osteoarthritis of her knee. She lives 90 miles from the nearest VA medical center, and she functions as a part-time home health aide with no paid leave. She is the primary caregiver for her mother as well, and she has transportation challenges. Her initial presentation, she came in and reported worsening knee pain, suboptimal glycemic control with an elevated hemoglobin A1C, fatigue, and difficulty sleeping. She's tried numerous diets already. She also participated in the VA MOVE program and has used VA formulary medications such as naltrexone and liraglutide. She's not found any long-term success with the diet plans, the MOVE program, or with any of the anti-obesity medicines or ALS thus far.
So thanks very much for starting us off on this case. But before we continue, I want to get our audience involved. So according to the VA Affairs, the Department of Defense 2020 guidelines, bariatric surgery should be considered when ongoing weight loss percentage and non-surgical interventions reflect which of the following. And so I want you all to record your answers. A, less than 5% after 6 months of lifestyle modifications and concurrent pharmacotherapy. B, less than 10% after a year of GLP-1 receptor antagonist therapy. C, less than 5% after 1 year of pharmacotherapy and lifestyle modifications. D, less than 3% after 3 months with either lifestyle modifications or pharmacotherapy. So this is it's hard to know. These all sound sort of similar. Or E, I'm not sure. Okay, and so the answer is going to be A, less than 5% after 6 months of lifestyle modifications and concurrent pharmacotherapy. And so now let's stop and talk about what we know so far. The patient's primary care clinician recommends bariatric surgery. And so, what do you all think about that?
I think this is probably an easy answer, and I am a bariatric surgeon, so that's my disclaimer. But naturally, she absolutely should be referred to what I would say now is a comprehensive obesity treatment center. And I think most of our programs are transitioning to a comprehensive obesity treatment center because we really think of this, again, I'm going to stress it probably multiple times, that this is a chronic disease. And we want to think of it like we do hypertension or diabetes, that there are layers of treatment that may be needed in each individual to get to their physiologic response. And so while she has tried lifestyle modifications, she's tried medications, I want people to take failure out of their vocabulary in those terms and instead talk about non-responders, super responders, and low responders. And so while she has not had a great response thus far to the MOVE program, which is heavily lifestyle and healthy lifestyle modification, and the initial AOM treatment, she hasn't been on the most optimal medication treatment likely yet. It's absolutely well worth trying that in this patient. And concurrently, while you're doing that, it is also absolutely worthwhile getting ready for a discussion about is surgery a possibility in the future. And I will say that talking about things at the same time and moving forward in multiple lanes is completely appropriate with obesity treatment.
Great.
Yeah, and if I could just add one thing, I agree obviously with everything Dr. Hussein said, and I just want to remind folks, in case they're not aware, that only 5% of people are able to be successful with in terms of long-term weight loss, with just diet and exercise alone. And so when people say things like, oh, this patient tried diet and exercise and then lost weight and then regained it, and as though that's kind of some kind of judgment or a failure on the part of that patient, that's really a very typical experience. And it suggests that we as clinicians have not really figured out how to help these patients achieve their long-term goals. And this is where, optimizing medications certainly can help. And it's amazing that we have these GLP-1s now that do seem to help quite a lot of patients. And even for those patients where those medications are really effective, the amount of weight loss is still less than what most patients would get on average with bariatric surgery. Of course, it's hard to know for an individual patient what their outcomes would be, but those are some additional things that I think about.
Very nice. Thank you. Okay, so Dr. Hussein, if you can pick up where we left off with our patient case.
Absolutely. So Angela's PCP does recommend her for bariatric surgery, and she comes to the initial bariatric surgery group information session. While there, she notices she's the only woman of color present. She perceives some judgmental language that is directed at her by the surgeon during this presentation. She hears quotes like, "Surgery is not for people looking for an easy way out. You have to prove you're serious." The process requires about a 6-month supervised program before surgery. Angela is naturally worried. She has to be able to get time off from work during this time, and she has to be able to travel to these multiple appointments. So there are many barriers of care in her case. The long travel distance for the pre- and post-op visits is significant because we know she lives over 90 miles away from her closest VA. There's financial strain from costs for gas, unpaid leave, and being away from her caregiving duties for her mom as well. There's some cultural disconnect in communication and how she's hearing that message that's being sent by the surgeons. And I think as surgeons, that's something we really need to own, is that sometimes the things we're saying we think are encouraging people. It's not the easy way out. You have to work hard, but it can be perceived as very negative for the patients. And so understanding that and really thinking about how we're communicating this message of commitment to this process without it being a punitive type thing being put on them. There are a lot of rigid eligibility requirements currently with insurance, and this is my soapbox likely, that sometimes insurance determines our care. There are many steps that may or may not be medically necessary, but are predetermined as mandatory by insurances, and that can make it very hard for people to complete the pathway. And there's implicit bias in this presentation, focusing on motivation instead of systemic barriers and physiologic knowledge of obesity as a disease, not again quite re recognizing that it's not about your self-control or your motivation, but your brain determines a lot of times what your weight and your body habitus is and how you respond to treatment. And so, are we supposed to strong will ourselves out of our brains functioning is the question. And the answer should be no, that we need to re Were that in our own world as well.
All of those are such excellent points because even though the guidelines have changed around eligibility, there's still so many sort of structural issues that make it difficult for people to still access the same care. And then you mentioned a lot of the cultural disconnects when people of color are frequently already stereotyped as being lazy or unmotivated or non-adherent, that those messages may trigger other experiences they've had or feelings they've had about care. And so all of these things are really important for us to sort of notice that this may be baggage people are bringing with them to the encounter that may make their experience less than ideal. And so when we think about social drivers of health, social determinants of health, and how they relate to bariatric surgery, Dr. Salas already did a really good job of describing so much of that when she was talking about disparities in care, around, insurance, the structural inequities around race and ethnicity, and how that is related to, class and income. It's also related to education, health literacy. And your job in this country determines for the most part your insurance level still. And so many of these things really are driven by poverty and your access to resources. Some is related to geography and whether or not you're in a rural versus an urban area. Many times rural areas just don't have the physical resources. And then if you're in a very urban area that's low income, you may still be in a desert despite the urban area having lots of resources. You may still, be on the south side of Chicago or on the west side of Philadelphia, where there may still be lots of resources that you're missing. And while there are structural inequities in our society, those same structural inequities exist within our healthcare system. And so all of these things act on patients as they navigate our healthcare system, as they navigate, life outside of our healthcare system. To make them susceptible to obesogenic environments, and affect whether or not they're even candidates, for surgery, and their ability to access surgery. And so, these are things that are really important. And so this, next slide that we see, shows some sample questions that we may want to ask, in terms of bariatric surgery that we could ask our patients. To try and get to some of these social drivers, and then be able to try and address them, to try and decrease the barriers that patients have and be more patient-centered in increasing the access of everyone to equal care. So instead of assuming that people's non-adherence, is related to a lack of willingness to take medications, I always ask them, what happened? I was in clinic all day yesterday. And someone was like, "Well, I'm taking all these medications, but the last refill," and I looked and it was true, they were only given a 30-day refill with 30 days of medications with 0 refills. And so I said, "I'm going to put in for 90 days with 3 refills. You shouldn't have to be like constantly, asking through the phone tree to get, refill medications and stuff." And so, yeah, there are lots of things that we can do as providers within our systemic limitations to try and make things easier for patients.
Yeah, and
So,
I think if I could just add to that, I 100% agree with all of that. And I think we have a tendency, especially when we are very busy and struggling to just keep up with our own work and seeing all the patients that we need to see, it can be easy to excuse things like, well, this patient's not doing well because they have poor health literacy, because they have poor education, because they didn't do XYZ thing. And I think one really big challenge for us in healthcare is to shift that thinking along the lines of that slide and think, okay, recognizing the limitations that our patients have through no fault of their own, what can we be doing better to help patients who don't have access to resources to achieve the same health outcomes as other people who do? And of course, that's going to take investment from our healthcare systems, right? That's not a thing that we're going to one by one try to solve ourselves. And we have to put pressure on our healthcare systems to do better by our patients.
Exactly. Recognizing there were in a system that's full of structural inequities, and how can we think about those and try and balance some of that out for our patients who are trying to navigate their way to wellness. And so, next, we're going to shift to talking about some of the interpersonal issues and implicit bias. And so, this one statement that we've talked about already about the from this a surgeon is really revealing, where the surgeon said, "Surgery is not for people who are looking for an easy way out. You have to prove you're serious." And so, the implicit bias. So this is a definition. It's an automatic reaction that we have towards people. And so these attitudes and stereotypes can negatively impact our understanding, actions, and decision-making about people. Biases are cognitive shortcuts. They help us sort of make sense of the world, to sort of categorize things, people, and places quickly to help us sort of digest large volumes of information. And they're evolutionary, something that helps us process large data. So that's great. But sometimes they fire in ways that are not helpful, and create negative things for ourselves and for other people. And so, we have to use our slow cognitive pathways to help us put into check these negative shortcuts to help us make sure that we are practicing the best care that we can for patients. And we can actually measure our own biases with a number of tests. So there's one called the Project Implicit website that was developed. And we can sort of measure our implicit biases for a number of different things. But it's really important that we all acknowledge that we have them, that they impact patient care. And so then we can begin to do something about it. And we have biases not just by race and gender, but also by weight. And so, Dr. Salas, can you talk about the statement, obesity bias is the last socially acceptable form of prejudice? What does that mean?
Yeah, and I'll admit that that's a little bit dated now. I mean, this is something that we used to say maybe about 5-ish years ago. And I think it was relatively true at that point in time that we had become, as a society, more aware of how certain statements might be inappropriate with regard to, for example, a person's sex or a person's race or ethnicity. And yet people would pretty consistently and freely make negative judgments about people with obesity, without really seeming to expect any backlash around that. And that's kind of what that statement was about, that obesity bias is so omnipresent that it didn't really seem to raise a red flag for people in the same way that other types of stereotypical statements or discriminatory statements about other aspects of identity might. I have to say, I do feel a little bit that that may no longer be the case, as we have turned a tide, in a sense, in our society, where we're seeing more rather than less discriminatory statements being made by our so-called leaders, by the media, and just by people in our everyday lives. So I'm actually not sure that that statement is accurate anymore, although I do think for sure that people still feel very comfortable making negative judgments of people with obesity in ways that they should not. And the data that we have on this are plenty. There have been many, many studies showing that both people just in the general public have neg hold negative views about people with obesity, but also to do physicians and other healthcare workers. So some of the data that's out there are looking at, for example, PA and psychology students who tended to say that patients with obesity are difficult, unmotivated, and non-compliant was the term that was used in that study. Many of them had also witnessed negative comments about people with obesity from others during the course of their training. There's older data from the IAT that, as you just mentioned, from Project Implicit, showing that physicians hold moderately or strong negative implicit bias about patients, regardless of their own weight. Sometimes people ask that, is do people with obesity have less negative bias about people with obesity? And it tends to generally not be the case. I mean, implicit bias tends to be a reflection of the society we're in more than individuals' beliefs or anything like that. And it's the same reason that you see women will also have negative hold negative implicit biases about women in careers, for example. And that's we published data on that if anyone's interested. But anyway, continuing on with what we know about obesity and people's perspectives, there are studies showing, even large studies showing that, again, medical doctors, regardless of their BMI, their race or ethnicity or their gender, hold anti-fat bias. And I'll just make a small note there that the IAT that is done for obesity uses the term fat, as opposed to using the term obesity. That may be more stigmatizing. There hasn't been a direct comparison of using one term or the other for the IAT, but just a little footnote there. And there are other data that show that providers tend to view patients with obesity as non-compliant, lazy, lacking self-control, awkward, weak-willed, sloppy, unsuccessful, unintelligent, and even dishonest. And so these views are, again, pretty prevalent even in the medical environment. And that, of course, I hope it's obvious to folks, can lead to worse outcomes for patients with obesity. And in my opinion, likely contributes to some of the disparities we see in health outcomes for patients with obesity. So there are some little things that we can do in our clinics just to try to be a little bit less stigmatizing for people with obesity and to make them feel more comfortable and welcome in our spaces. And that's things like not having arms on our chairs or having much wider chairs than some clinics typically do, just to, again, indicate that we understand people of all different sizes may come into our clinic. It also includes things like having blood pressure cuffs of different sizes to fit different people and making sure that our exam tables can support different weights and that our gowns also come in different sizes so that pretty much everyone who comes into our clinic spaces can feel comfortable. The last thing anyone wants is to feel like the space is not made for them.
Right. I noticed that when we made a change in our chairs so that we had double-sized chairs in our rooms, I noticed it, and I think that our patients probably noticed that as well and made a big difference. So we have one more audience response question. And so the question is, which of the following is considered a non-stigmatizing term with respect to individuals with obesity and related comorbidities? A, weight loss surgery. B, morbidly obese. C, uncontrolled diabetes. D, bariatric metabolic surgery. Or E, I'm not sure. And so the answer is bariatric metabolic surgery. And so I'll let you all maybe quickly weigh in on some of the reasons why that might be. But just for me, just jumping out, there's uncontrolled with diabetes, morbid with obese, and then with the surgery sort of focusing on the weight loss aspect of it as opposed to the surgery, just sort of describing what it is without any sort of judgment or subjective assessment of that. Anything else that you guys would want to add to that?
Yeah, just very quickly, I would add there was a great article that came out a few years back looking at how the language that we use around obesity and how it can be stigmatizing. And so just kind of underlining the point that was made by that question, there's some very simple things we can do to shift our language. For example, instead of saying obese, we can talk about obesity and use person first language. So this is a person with obesity, not an obese person. Instead of just as you were saying, instead of talking about morbid obesity, we can talk about severe obesity. Instead of talking about things that are good or bad, we can talk about things that are more or less healthy in terms of, like, for example, food or habits that people might have. And instead of talking about exercise, we can talk about physical activity, which seems to be less off-putting to a lot of people. You've already heard probably in this session that instead of using non-compliance, we're tending to use non-adherence. And then in terms of any sort of endeavor around weight loss, whether it's medications or surgery, people sometimes will talk about recidivism, which is a term that's really associated with crime and doesn't really fit in the healthcare setting. So we should talk about weight regain, not recidivism.
Absolutely.
In addition to some of the data we discussed earlier around the implicit association test, our team did just recently publish an update looking at more recent data to see if there were any changes in the opinions or perspectives for both implicit and explicit bias amongst folks who care for patients. And the real key takeaways, just two of them I want to briefly summarize, are one, that folks the IAT categorizes as diagnosing and treating practitioners, which are physicians and dentists and folks who are making treatment decisions, tended to have higher levels of anti-fat bias than other types of healthcare workers or people who are not healthcare workers. However, the good news is that across all the groups of folks included in these data, which was, by the way, over 1 million folks represented, about 40,000 of them being healthcare workers, or diagnosing and treating practitioners, I should say. Across all three of these groups, there tended to be less explicit bias over time, which I think is a positive finding. Explicit bias is what we say we believe, whereas implicit bias is more automatic and unconscious. So it could be that we see this because there is a greater recognition that it's not appropriate to have bias against people with obesity, or it could be that attitudes are really changing. Unfortunately, those data don't allow us to disentangle that.
Right. So thank you, Dr. Hussein. We're going to go back to our patient case and see how that final, how it wrapped up and how it concluded.
Great. Well, Angela did decide to proceed with surgery and elected to have a gastric bypass. After gastric bypass, she was readmitted for dehydration due to unclear discharge instructions. She misses follow-up because of transportation issues and lack of flexible scheduling. 1 year later, she's regained 30 pounds and her diabetes has returned to pre-op levels. So the key takeaways here are that bariatric surgery outcomes are influenced by not only patient behavior, but by systemic, cultural, and structural barriers that clinicians must actively identify and address. And many of these barriers were really clearly identified in her preoperative assessment, but then not addressed adequately in the perioperative care, leading to some of these challenges that she faced.
That I think that's a wonderful way of phrasing that. Like, we saw them in the pre-op as flags, things that she was concerned about, things that we were thinking about that then manifested. And then Dr. Salas had talked about some of the post-op disparities that we see. And so a lot of this could be avoided if we had a more coordinated team, if we had some case management and care management. And so how do you all work as part of interprofessional teams in bariatric care? And what does that look like in your practices?
Yeah, right now I think of our practices as being quite lucky in our team approach and our interprofessional care. One of the advantages we have, I think, over sometimes primary care that can be very resource lacking is that part of having a certified bariatric team is having the inclusion of things like registered dietitians, behavioral health therapists in the form of anything from psychologists to social workers, psychiatrists, etc., having nurse navigators who can help patients with some of the challenges that they are facing. And so we have this interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary team. And what it really helps with, in my impression, is that it's not on one person to catch all of these things. Those questions we talked about is how do you incorporate questions to identify some of the challenges that patients may face? In our practice, often they are part of our normal workflow now because our dietitians do such a wonderful job of identifying barriers. They talk about how do you prep your food generally, where do you eat, where is the closest grocery store to you, etc. And so they're bringing that to us, and it's really helping to share the load of caring for the patient the best way we can.
Yes, thank you. Okay, ladies, we are out of time, but I thank you so much for this session. Very, very informative, and I just appreciate your personal dedication and service for this patient population, for all the work that you do. And so thank you for joining us today. I'm going to try and summarize with a few brief SMART goals, and those are goals that are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. And so our SMART goals for today are to recognize obesity as a disease and to treat all individuals, particularly of differing racial and ethnic backgrounds, different kinds of social identities, with dignity, regardless of body size. Our second is to encourage empathy and understanding by all team members. And so we have to have a team in first, but by all team members, and to reflect your own potential implicit biases. A third, to refer and treat patients with severe obesity who are appropriate candidates and interested in bariatric surgery. And last, focus on health and functional improvements and avoid framing weight loss solely as personal responsibility. Really, this is a chronic disease. It's a pathophysiologic condition with lots of hormonal imbalances, and we need to be thinking about this like we would any other chronic condition. There are a lot of suggested resources that are here for you as you help your patients navigate their way to wellness, as we have for all of our chronic conditions. And so these are here for you. So thank you all for joining us. Please don't miss the other program in this series, which is entitled Optimizing Biomarker Usage in Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. And so this series is entitled Advancing Health Equity Across the Spectrum. So we also encourage you to visit our CME Outfitters Health Access and Social Responsibility Hub at the URL that's on your screen. To receive credit for this activity, please complete the post-test and evaluation. Then you'll immediately receive your certificate for your participation today. So thank you again for our audience for joining us today, and thank you to our guests so much for your expertise and for your time and for just all that you do. Thanks so much.